Welcome to PM Lessons Learned, a podcast for project managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Increase your PM knowledge, build business relationships, increase your effectiveness, increase your marketability, gain professional support. Join our group and take part in our conference calls. Details at pmlessonslearned.com.
Hello, and welcome to the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP exam study group conference call and podcast. This is podcast number 111. We're recording the session on the 2nd of December, 2010, and we are totally focused on version 4 of the PMBOK guide. My name is Dana Safford. I'm your host for this PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP exam study group conference call. I've been a PMP since version 2 of the PMBOK. I'm also a certified ITIL version 3 expert and a Microsoft certified systems engineer. I have over 25 years of project management experience in the IT industry. I work for Hewlett-Packard as a complex problem manager, and in this role I take a very complex situation that is affecting an HP customer's enterprise production environment, and I manage a project with a virtual technical team that quickly resolves the issue. So remember, you don't have to have the term project manager in your job title to actually be a project manager. Our presenter for this session is me, and our topic is project management basics. Talk about a little bit of an abstract here. The PMP exam is based on version 4 of the Guide to the Project Management Body of Knowledge, or the PMBOK. This month's PMP exam study group call begins the focus on the first three chapters of the PMBOK. We've been focusing on a whole bunch of other chapters, and now we're going to spend a couple of sessions on the first three chapters and some appendices in the PMBOK. This session provides basic project descriptions and the various phase workflow alternatives that project managers can use. Version 4 of the PMBOK changed a few things in this area, and I'll provide insight and practical examples of everything you'll need to know to begin building your critical knowledge mass and pass the PMP exam on the first attempt. If you haven't downloaded a PDF copy of today's presentation, please do so. If you are in the live freec.com virtual meeting room, the file is in the lobby. To find out how to download the files and the podcast for all of the PM Lessons Learned sessions, go to www.pmlessonslearned.com, and in the left navigation column, you'll see a link to files and presentations. Just follow those directions, and what you'll end up with is the file for this session. The file name for this session is PMLL, Project Management Basics, and the date, 2 December 10, and it's a PDF file. And the actual title that's on the line as well is PMLL Project Management Basics 2 December 10 as well. So you'll find it in our file area. Also in the file area, you will see the content from the last year's worth of conference calls. And an updated PMBOK version 4 brain dump is in there too. And if you look in the past PMP monthly exam study group conference call folder, you'll find some other files. I did some housekeeping in there, so most of the really old stuff is gone, but there are some things in there that are based on version 3 of the PMBOK guide, and you can find things elsewhere on the Internet as well. The Internet is a very big place, so if you choose to use material from another source or some of our version 3 material, make sure you know it's PMBOK based. The material that you want for this version of the test is version 4. You should remember there's roughly about a 30% difference from version 3 to version 4, and it's pretty much all in the processes in their ITTOs, or inputs, tools, and techniques, and outputs. And finally, this is the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP exam study group conference call and podcast. If you are on a shorter time scale and are willing to make a commitment to actively participate and take turns presenting study group material, our weekly PMP exam study group may be the right place for you. For more information, send an email to pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com. So, we are pmlessonslearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. Thank you in advance for all those participants on the live conference call that we have going right now. You've all been muted and shut off entry tone so no one will hear anybody else coming on. I'll also say thank you to all the people who download the podcast. So, let's get started. So, on slide number one, where we are right now, this is basically the listing of all of our conference calls. This being the first Thursday of the month, we have our PMP exam study group conference call. And on the second Thursday of the month, we have our PM Lessons Learned job shop call. That's where you can go if you're in transition or want to work on your resume or have some other things you'd like to work from a career point of view. Then on the third Thursday of each month, we have our PM Lessons Learned Best Practice Call. This is where our host and founder, Henry Will, provides presentations on a whole variety of project management topics. If Henry's not doing the presentation, then he's got somebody who's written a book or another practitioner who will be doing the presentation for that month. There's always a lot of good stuff to learn when you attend that call, so please do. And you can listen to any of our previous calls or download the podcast and slides by going to, as I mentioned, www.pmlessonslearned.com. And if you'd like to join our Yahoo and LinkedIn groups, please feel free to do that. I'm going to move to the next slide, and we'll talk about the norms for this call. It's an interactive call. I'd like it to be as interactive as we can. So as we go along, everyone's muted for right now. But what you can do is unmute your phone by hitting a *6 on your phone. That will unmute yourself. You can get my attention, yell my name out, whatever. So you get my attention, go ahead, and then I'll recognize you, ask your question. And then when you're done, please, we'll ask you to do a *6 and remute yourself so you don't get a lot of background noise here on the call. And we also won't talk over each other so much. Okay, moving on to the next slide. Here's our email address. It is pmstudy@pmlessonslearned.com. Everybody should know that by now. And on the next slide, I have a bit of legalese. The participants in this call are really meant to use this session as additional study material. As a result, I don't have a whole lot of graphics on these slides. If you have graphics, you need the accompanying audio to make that happen. And if you don't get a chance to download the podcast or if you don't have it with you, whatever, you can still study from the slides themselves because they're pretty much a lot of text. Folks have told me they find that more helpful, so that's the way I've got it set up. Much of the information in this session comes from an actual study guide. It's the Project Management Professional Exam Study Guide, the 5th edition, authored by Kim Heldman, published as part of the CYBEX series by John Wiley & Sons. You see the ISBN number there, so that if you want to go buy a copy of the book, it's a very good value. It's a 2-inch thick paperback book with practice questions, things along those lines. Also has a CD in the back with a test engine, more practice tests, and the like, all for anywhere from $40 to $60 U.S., depending upon where you buy it from. So go out and grab that. It's a very good study guide. I'm using this material with the permission of the publisher. I am a registered instructor with John Wiley. I'm going to move on to the next slide, and we get to the title slide of this session. And we'll be talking about project management basics, and today is the 2nd of December, 2010. I'm going to move on to the next slide, and we get into just what is a project. Is it a project? What are they? Projects are unique activities, unique actions, and they're very temporary in nature. They have a definitive beginning and a definitive end date. You'll see those two big red exam dots there. Anytime you see one of those dots on any of my slides, that means that this question or this point is most likely going to be on the PMP exam. So please pay close attention to those and be ready for those. The question will be worded maybe in some different way than what I'm portraying it, but it will most likely be on the test. And we know projects are completed when the goals of the project are achieved. You've got a set of goals you've laid out. Once you get those done, that's a clue that you might be done with your project. And also, a successful project is one that meets the expectations of your stakeholders, whoever they happen to be. And we'll talk about stakeholders in a few slides from now. I'm going to move on to the next slide, and let's talk about what is not a project, what isn't a project. There are a lot of activities that you might be doing that have no specific deliverable. It's an ongoing type of thing, no end date, no deliverable. That's a clue that it's not a project. It's really in operations. Why? Because that exam point there says operations are ongoing and they're repetitive. If you do the same report every month, or the same task every month, that's really not a project. That really is an operation. Some people might call it a project if they're not aware of things, but for the exam, you want to pay attention to anything that's ongoing that you do all the time, once a week, once a day, once a month, whatever. That's really not a project. And operations involve work that's continuous without an end date, and they always tend to produce the same results, and the report may vary from month to month. But in general, you're doing the same report, the same output all the time. That's not a project. That is just something that is ongoing. Moving on to the next slide, let's talk about how projects are created. What causes a project to begin in the first place? And what we find here, for this exam point, there's a bunch of different needs and demands. that come to play when projects are created. There's a market demand, and that is when, for some reason, a lot of people want to buy something. Maybe there's a demand for a car that is more efficient, fuel efficient, something along those lines. The electric cars, there's starting to be a demand for electric cars and things along those lines. So a company will come up with a project to build a product to meet a market need. There'll be a business need as well. Perhaps in whatever environment, business, whatever you are in, you have a need for a specific training package or something like that. Well, you're going to have a project that you'll be in to develop the training material. And then once that is delivered, because that's a short term, you're delivering training material and you're delivering it in, say, 2 months. That's a project. The ongoing delivery of that class, maybe that's a monthly or weekly class that happens, that's not a project. That's operations. But the effort to build up training material is a project. And perhaps there's a customer request going on. The example here, a new substation for electric utility or something along those lines. There is enough customer demand for something out there that, or customer request, hey, put a new bridgehead server here for this ISP or something along those lines to spread the load out a little bit more. Or maybe there's a technological advance that's come along that allows something to be done faster, cheaper, better, and you might want to have a project that'll take advantage of that technological advance. Or maybe there's a legal requirement. Maybe there's a brand new safety guideline or legal requirement, a new law, a new EPA law comes into play, and you've got to start a project to maybe put smoke scrubbers on the smokestack of your plant, or of your building, or something along those lines. That would be a project because there's a legal requirement that forces you to do something. And then finally, a social need. Maybe there's something going on that you really see the need to do something to benefit humanity or something along those lines. And you're just trying to meet whatever social need might be out there. So those are all the things that can bring projects into play, into being. Moving on to the next slide, you'll see and hear a lot about something called progressive elaboration. And the exam point there says that this is an incremental process that is used to define the characteristics of the product or the service or the result, the deliverables of your project. So it's incremental, and it goes through numerous iterations. So first time through, you know a little bit about your project. Maybe the second time through, you know a little bit more. The third time through, a little bit more. And there's no limit to the number of times you can go through a similar set of material because you're further along, you know more, and you can hence put more into your plan. You can put more into your deliverables, those types of things. That is progressive elaboration. And you see it mostly toward the beginning of the project, so when you're trying to figure out what the scope of your project is, maybe developing a set of requirements, things along those lines. And as you get more in the later phases, you don't see so much progressive elaboration. You tend to see it more in the front, but it can happen anywhere within the project, for sure. Then move on to the next slide. And let's talk about some really important people. Those are your stakeholders. These stakeholders are actually people, or they could be entire organizations, like the federal government. If you're doing a project that involves the federal government, no matter what country you are in, can be a stakeholder as well. These are people or organizations that have a vested interest in your project. They have a piece of the action, if you will. They have a stake in the game. They have maybe financial, maybe political, maybe functional or operational power over your project. And you have to pay attention to those folks because they can hurt you big time if you don't. So they're actively involved, at least in the beginning, maybe not toward the end, but they're actively involved in your project or have something to gain or lose as a result of your project happening. And you know your project will be successful when you can meet their needs. If they're happy, if your stakeholders are happy, then you've got a good project going on there. And your stakeholders can change from the beginning of the project to the end of the project. So it's not a one-time process. They ebb and they flow depending on what's going on. And the exam point there, key stakeholders can make or break the success of your project. If those folks are not happy, they could reduce funding for your project and you're going to be hurting. So you want to make sure you always keep your stakeholders happy. And make sure you identify them as early in the project as you can so you can make sure you identify their needs and you meet their needs. And if you leave somebody out and don't discover it until well within your project, you could be in a world of hurt because then you might have already upset them and they may do something to put an end to your project. Moving on to the next slide is a little organization chart style discussion of who a stakeholder could be. At the top, you see the project itself. the next box down is the project manager, and then along the branches of our horizontal organization chart, if you will, for those who don't have the slides in front of you, I got a bunch of boxes that basically have a list of the stakeholders, and I'll read them off. They are project sponsors themselves, department managers, customers, vendors, boards of directors, suppliers, executive managers, and it could be anybody with, that, like you said, a vested interest in your project. So we just sort of be aware of that as you're moving along so you can identify who's whom and make sure you cover things. I'm going to move to the next slide and talk about another little graphic, basically is a bunch of concentric circles, and talk about the relationship between stakeholders and your project. You as the project manager are sort of in the middle of the set of concentric circles, and you've got a project management team around you. If you're in a large organization, maybe you've got some associates, some helpers that help you manage the project. Maybe you don't. Maybe there's nobody in that circle. And then outside of that, you have your project team. At the top of all of this, you have your sponsors. That's your main person. We'll talk a little bit more about sponsors as we hit the next couple of slides. And then you've got your stakeholders that surround everything. So as you think about projects, you need to worry about this entire concentric circle grouping of individuals, of organizations that have an impact on your project. And you don't want to ignore those people because they can either help or hurt you. When the point down the bottom of the slide is, remember, the project manager of a competing project could also be a stakeholder in your project. Because depending upon how the politics are in your organization, there could be enough competition for scarce resources that if they do something, they could wind up stealing funds from your project, stealing resources from your project, and things along those lines. So you want to make sure that you understand this who's whom as you're working through your projects. Moving on to the next slide. And then we'll talk about project sponsors. This is most of the time one individual, maybe a couple of individuals at different levels in the organization, but it's generally somebody in your organization with the authority to assign resources, hence funding, human resources, equipment, things along those lines, and enforce decisions regarding your project. They're also a stakeholder, the exam point that's there. The other two exam points are the stakeholder generally serves as a tiebreaker, so if something's going on and you're not quite sure what to do, you've got differing factions that are warring over a certain aspect of your project, I always go to my project sponsor and say, hey, this is going on, I'm going to need your help. In fact, I was talking to one of my project sponsors earlier this week. One of my projects had a scope change in it. And we had a couple of differing factions trying to say, yes, I want to do this, no, I want to do that type of thing. And I used the project sponsor in order to break the tie and make the management decision. I told them where I wanted it to go, but they made the final decision. So use your sponsor to make those decisions, those tiebreaker things, and use them to help you remove roadblocks. They can be very beneficial because they're higher up in the organization most of the time. They have more political clout in the organization, and they can make things happen where you might not be able to. Okay, moving on to the next slide. We've got a bit of a graphic here that I will describe for those who are not in the room. Basically, we've got a bunch of boxes here. They're talking about the relationship between the project manager, the project team, and the various sponsors, where you've got a project team in the lower levels of things. You as a project manager sit on top directing things, and there are two lines coming out from the top of this box over to two different sponsors. You might have a sponsor who is maybe in lower or middle management, and that sponsor was in lower or middle management. For those with the slides in front of you at the bottom of the two blue boxes, for maintenance types of projects where it's an ongoing type of, not an operational thing, that training project that I was telling you about earlier could be a maintenance kind of project. There's some new aspect of something they have to pay attention to. There are, though, sometimes very strategic projects that mean a big deal to the organization. Those are the priority projects that come about, and those will probably have a higher level sponsor, higher than your lower the middle management, and you use those for those really strategic ones, and they can help you break through some of these strategic roadblocks. And then in the rest of the graphic here, it talks about some of the things that your sponsors can do. No matter what level your sponsor is, they can do to help you out. They can do things like help you set objectives, make sure that you understand all the objectives that your project needs to fulfill, maybe help with some upfront planning, maybe with some organization and staffing, working out some scope and master planning. If you have any execution you have to pay attention to as you're doing your controlling and executing phase, we'll talk about later on in this session, they might have some ways to help you with that. They can certainly help you set priorities. Their highest priority should be your highest priority as well. As we've mentioned, they can work through conflict resolution for you, and they can be a contact with the rest of management. And so they can help you remove hurdles you may run into, so you want to make sure you know who your sponsors are and you keep them happy, as well as your other stakeholders. So I'm going to move on to the next slide, and let's talk about the influences that can go along in a project. Your stakeholders can certainly have a great influence on your project, but their influence is going to vary as time moves on. What will happen is, if you look at the graphic that's at the bottom of this slide, you see two basically S-curves. And the X-axis of these curves is time. So day zero of the project through the end of the project, whatever that happens to be. And on the Y-axis, you see the degree of influence of stakeholders, the top line starting at the upper left hand of the graphic and guessing down and to the right shows you that stakeholder influence is very high in the beginning of a project. You have to make sure that your stakeholders agree to your project. There's funding that has to be approved. There's just general organizational approvals that have to happen. So if they don't like your project, they can kill your project before it starts. So their influence is extremely high in the very beginning. But as time goes on and you've started your project and you're moving along, if you're halfway, three-quarters of the way through your project, they don't have as much influence because you've got a lot of sunk resources already in this project, so it's something you've already spent. They can't get that money back. So they may be just feel like, well, letting you finish the project because it's less money to finish the project than it is to stop it. So their influence and their interest might wane as time goes on, depending upon who your stakeholders are. And the rest of that slide also shows risk is a lot higher because your risk of projects not happening are high at the beginning. If you are the proponent of a project and you're competing against a dozen other projects and there's only enough funding for two projects, then there's a very high risk, 2 in 12, that your project will be started and the rest of the risk of it not starting at all because there isn't enough funding. So you need to be aware of that, that the risk is highest in the beginning. That's an exam point. And also the other exam point there is the ability to influence the final characteristics of a project, ebb and flow in that same vein. You can really influence the final result of a project in the very beginning when all the requirements are still being generated, still being gathered. And you don't want a red thing, you want a blue thing, whatever it happens to be. You won't want a little one, you want a big one, whatever the case might be. But as you're working through and you're halfway through your project, it might be kind of difficult to take a little widget and turn it into a big widget or something along those lines. So the ability to make those changes diminishes over time. And that's what this whole graphic and this slide's all about. So I'm going to move on to the next slide and begin to talk about generally what project management is. I'm on the slide titled Project Management. And here we're talking that project management brings together some gathering of tools and techniques performed by humans, people, that will describe, organize, and monitor a set of activities that will provide deliverables for the outcome of your project. Right? And the project managers are the management folks that run that. They're project team people who are the worker bees, the doers, if you will, but the project managers are the people that lead the activities. So project management is that set of tools and techniques making things happen, and the project managers are the leaders that make the things happen. Right? And all projects really are composed of a bunch of different processes. They may or may not be organized. They can be in a nice framework, a nice methodology, depending upon where you work, what your environment is that you're working in. Some companies have a very detailed, dictated project management methodology that you must go through. You must do step one, and then step two, and then step three. Other companies, not so much. You'd be pretty much on your own, and it's really tough sometimes to figure out if you've met all the needs of your stakeholders with those types of projects or those types of companies, but you can do it. It's possible for it to happen. So the level of framework, the level of methodology will vary depending upon your company. The exam point there on this slide says that project management involves applying all the knowledge, skills, tools and techniques and all those things during the course of the project to accomplish whatever the objective of the project is. If your project is to design a car, to build a house or whatever the case may be, it's all that stuff that you apply in order to achieve the end game of whatever your project is. And as a project manager, it's your responsibility to make sure that whatever processes you have to follow are actually followed. That's the best way to describe what a project manager does. I'm going to move on to the next slide. And let's talk about project management. It's sort of like a stool. So for those who don't have the slide deck in front of you, you've got a picture of a three-legged stool here. three-legged stools are interesting things because when everything is balanced correctly and they're stable, things go rather nicely. So picture on the legs of a three-legged stool. One leg is the project manager themselves. The next leg is line management. The third leg is senior management or sponsors, whatever the case may be. If all those three people, all those three legs are aligned correctly, things are quite stable and that stool will not topple over. But as soon as one of those gets out of sync somewhere along the lines, you can start leaning in one direction or another, and you could topple over. So it's sort of like a balancing act as you're moving along. Speaking of moving along, I'm going to go to the next slide, and we'll look at basically what looks like a pie chart. I call it the top of the stool, and see on the top of things what also has to be aligned, measured, and managed, and that is organizational structure that you're dealing with, the organizational behavior, and various tools and techniques. Organizational structure we'll get into probably in the next session or the session after that. It's big enough that I'm going to pull it into a separate session. Organizational behavior is something that goes along all the time, depending on what organization you're in. And there's a ton of tools and techniques. The PMBOK is full of tools and techniques. We're not going to go over any tonight, but in all the knowledge areas that we've gone through in the past, all the nine knowledge areas that we've been through over the past year of these presentations all come into play on the top of the stool there. And they all have their inputs and their outputs, and the mix varies depending upon the type and scale and scope of your project. Moving on to the next slide, let's talk two slides worth of skills, but the skills is another area I'm going to pull off into another session. So eventually you will see another session, another podcast on skills. I haven't done it yet, so it'll be a number higher than the 111 that we are with this podcast. But basically, every project manager needs a good set of skills because they're sort of like running their own small business, if you will. They need a bunch of good general management skills to make sure they know how to direct and lead and do reports and things along those lines, general management skills, managing people, those types of things. They also have to have some level of application skills. And by application skills, we don't just mean Microsoft Project or Primavera or TeamPlay or whatever software you're talking about, but maybe you're in the construction area. There's a bunch of applications, things you have to worry about for construction. There is the PMBOK extension for construction or the federal government. It's the application of all those types of skills depending upon what industry you are in. So you have to sometimes have a very specialized set of skills depending upon the vertical industry you happen to be in. And in general, you have to be varied enough that you're a mile wide and an inch deep, or a kilometer wide and a centimeter deep, depending upon what measurement scheme you'd like to use. It's broad, but it's not very deep, is the point. I'm going to move on to the next slide. I'm going to list some of the skills that a project manager needs to have. They are communication skills, organizational and planning skills, budgeting skills, conflict management skills, negotiation and influencing skills, leadership skills, and team building and motivating skills. These are all things I'll talk about when I do the soft skills session. But I'm just going to mention them now, and you'll be able to pick that up when we do the next session on skills. So I'm going to move on to the next slide and talk a little bit more about project management, but from a macro point of view, if you will, because we've talked up till now about individual projects, one little project to build a birdhouse or to build one thing in one organization, and it's sort of like a little pigeonhole, if you will, one little project. But there are methodologies that you can use from a macro point of view to begin to aggregate all these little things. And you have a thing called programs, portfolios, and project management offices. And these are methodologies or activities or a set of tools and techniques, better way to say it, that still allow you to do all the same stuff we talked about before. The wording in the first bullet is pretty much the same wording as the first bullet on the other slide. But what it does is it takes and applies them from a higher point of view. So let's move on to the next slide and begin to talk about those. First, we'll talk about programs. When we talk about programs, these are groups of related projects, maybe sub-projects. The space shuttle is one big program, if you will, but it's got a whole bunch of little sub-projects, the navigation system, the propulsion system, the airframe, that types of thing. Each one has their own little project that they're doing something with, and they are most likely managed using the same techniques in some coordinated fashion. That's the exam point you see at the top. So a program is things that are related that are managed using the same methodology is another way to look at it. When projects are managed collectively as programs, you can start to get some synergy, some economies of scale going on, to use a couple of business terms. You can capitalize on those things and achieve benefits that wouldn't be achievable otherwise, because maybe it costs too much money to maintain a certain set of resources for a single project. But you can maintain that resource across a dozen projects that happen to make up a program. You amortize the cost of some of those things out over many projects as part of a program, and can justify things easier. Now, each sub-project or project will probably have its own project manager, or maybe not. Maybe one project manager handles a couple of different projects. But you're going to have some type of hierarchy, some different levels of project managers, depending upon how many levels are in the program. So maybe there's a head project manager who's responsible for the whole thing. It'll vary depending on what's going on. And that whole collection, when you collect all those projects together, put them together, figure out all their interdependencies, all their constraints, all the issues going on with each one of those, managed as a grouping, that's all called program management for that last bullet down the bottom. And moving on to the next slide, then we get into portfolios. It's a bigger, broader picture, if you will, because it can include the little tiny projects that we're talking about, but can also include programs. It can include numerous programs, not just one program. So a portfolio is just a bigger smattering, a bigger collection. And if you're in one company and you're doing portfolio management, you might have several large strategic programs going on for various aspects of the company, development projects that you're working on. And maybe you'll have a few other side projects off to the side. You can manage all of these as a portfolio, just like a stock portfolio or a mutual fund portfolio. We have a bunch of things with different goals. You can certainly manage all those together, and all with using a similar methodology, because your end game for an enterprise is most likely going to be you've got a mission statement moving in one direction. So all your portfolios, all your programs, all your projects can be aligned all toward the same direction. All right, so the overall objective is to get additional synergies and things along those lines. But now when you're talking about portfolios, you're talking about a whole lot more strategic objectives. So the big exam point you see there is portfolio management encompasses managing the collections of the programs, projects, and other stuff that goes on, and maybe some operational stuff that goes on as well. And those can be included in there as well. And maybe you've got other portfolios. You can have portfolios of portfolios. It can nest. Can have nested functions there. So as you go through and do these, each one of those strategic programs in your portfolio will have some type of value. Some may be more valuable than others, and that's where you get into some of the funding decisions, things along those lines. And you've got to pay attention and monitor what's going on, because if you've got a portfolio, you most likely have a whole bunch of things in different phases of their life. You may have some projects or programs that are just starting out, some that are partway through, and some that are closing or closed, and maybe they've been archived already, and you're collecting lessons learned and things along those lines. You never know how it could work out. But you can nest them and you can manage them all together through the different phases of their life cycle. We'll get into life cycle phasing in a moment. And normally, if you have a portfolio, you've got some level of senior manager doing it. You're not going to have a junior level project manager who's responsible for all this stuff. You're going to have somebody who's pretty senior, an executive vice president, who knows. Doesn't have to be executive vice president, but someone who's been around for a while and has a goodly amount of project management experience. Most likely, the progression is from small project to a program or several programs, and then a portfolio on top of that is the most likely progression. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next slide. And then we finally talk about project and program management offices. This is a really nifty buzzword, really nifty term that a lot of folks bandy about, and everybody means something different. Because this is it looks like it's one entity, it's really a continuum, if you will, ranging from, you go through the bullets there, just somebody who's collected a bunch of articles or a couple of templates or checklists and put them either in a notebook in a file cabinet someplace or put them on a website someplace. It could just be somebody who's responsible for collecting all these little tools. And the other extreme is the full-fledged portfolio management office, that nothing can occur in an enterprise without the blessing of this thing, and everybody is constrained by the methodology. You must follow steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for everything. So you've got that broad continuum. So it's really difficult when someone says program management office, what they really mean. You got to do a little bit of digging. For the exam, you can use that first point up there, and it's usually a centralized organizational unit that oversees the management of projects and programs throughout an organization. That'll be the great exam point. I didn't put an exam point on that slide, but that's a good one to use. for the exam, and the rest of the things down there are just talking about the continuum that I elaborated on at the beginning. Sometimes project management offices provide support functions, or they may do the project management training for junior-level project managers. They may provide mentoring services. They'll take a senior project manager from Project A, and maybe they'll have that person mentor some junior project managers on Project Z, something along those lines. It'll vary depending upon your organization, but it's where you try to do some level of organization of the various capabilities and the tools and things along those lines to try to move things forward in your company. Okay, moving on to the next slide. A little bit more about project and program management offices. They can exist in multiple places. You work in a large organization like myself at Hewlett-Packard. We don't have one program management office. Each organization has their own. And within an organization, there can be sub-program management offices. So it doesn't have to be just one per organization. It'll vary depending upon the size and capability of whatever organization you're working in. So it can be at any level. It can be in a functional projectized or a matrix organization. We'll talk about organizational influences in another session. There's enough stuff in there to have it take its own hour or so. They will most likely have full authority to oversee projects, including having the authority to cancel a project if you don't meet certain hurdles that we'll talk about in a couple of slides from now. Or maybe they're just an advisory thing. Yeah, we recommend this goes on, but someone else has the actual approval. You never know. They have different names. They might be called a project office, center of excellence, something along those lines. They can have different names. It doesn't matter what you call it. Rose by any other name is still a project management office. And sometimes they're responsible for all the documentation. They collect the lessons learned. They might have somebody come into your project from the PMO and say, okay, I need to conduct a lessons learned meeting for your project, for your phase of your project, or whatever it happens to be. I've seen that happen plenty of times in the past as well. And whatever, they'll tend to maybe know what some of the objectives are as well, and they'll hope you to manage to those objectives, remind you from time to time there are things you have to pay attention to. And it all depends on what kind of authority they have. So I'm going to move on to the next slide and begin to talk about the phases, life cycles, and things along those lines. And I'm on a slide that's labeled Project Phases and Project Life Cycle Relationships. Because most projects are naturally divided into phases. You do different things when you're planning a project than when you're actually executing the project and then when you're closing the project. So this is naturally they divide into different phases. And the exam point there, project phases generally consist of different segments of work that allow for easier management. You can handle all the planning stuff in the front end for the most part if you have the traditional waterfall type of project management, which the PMI purports. So none of this stuff is for agile projects, not none of it. A goodly amount of it is not for agile projects. We're talking about traditional waterfall projects, and for those who don't know what a waterfall project is, you may know what a Gantt chart is. Have you seen the pictorial view of a project? You've got a bunch of activities listed down the left-hand side of a piece of paper, and you see a line over to the right-hand side of varying lengths that says when you're going to start, when you're going to finish. And those lines tend to line up in a stepwise manner going from the top left to the bottom right. Because normally you're going to talk about a task you're going to do in the beginning of a project at the top of the list. And it's something you're going to do at the end of the project at the bottom of the list. And since they're shifted in time, you tend to have a stepwise or waterfall orientation. That's why they're called waterfall projects. And the PMI loves waterfall projects. That's what everything ascribes to in the test. So just pay attention to that for the test. So the segments of work that go on and phases make that segmentation easier to do, easier to manage. They're generally sequential. Most of the time they do not overlap, although they can. You'll see in a couple of slides how they can overlap. The deliverables in the work produced are normally unique to that phase, but it doesn't have to be, but normally they're unique to that phase. Some projects can have just one phase, while others can have a whole bunch of phases, many phases, and they all have to be orchestrated and managed. And normally, if you've got a multiple-phase project, the end of one phase within the structure will allow your stakeholders and yourself as the project manager and your sponsor the opportunity to say, hey, how are we doing? Should we continue on into the next phase? You might have a phase review or something along those lines that you have to pass. You have to show a set of activities. You have to show that you've met your deliverables, your goals for the phase you're in now before you can move on to the next phase. And sometimes there is a very formal review big time meeting with a big thick notebook with the documentation, and other times there's nothing. It depends on your organization. But normally it gives you the opportunity to review phases, is what you have to remember for the exam. Moving on to the next slide, let's talk about the beginning of some of these phases. The phase structure allows a project to be segmented, just like we talked about in the other slide, to some logical subset to make it easy to manage. You see the graphic down there at the bottom of the slide. This is one of the graphics right out of the PMBOK. This is figure 2-3 from the PMBOK. It shows a project for installation of some telecommunications stuff, a network. And it's basically one short project. It has different processes inside, and you see some going around in the middle between planning and executing as they're talking through the monitoring and the controlling processes, and then it pops out. But everything is done in one phase. Then they do that because with this type of one-phase project, because it's generally all the same thing. You're not doing a lot of handing off. You're doing a quick design, perhaps, then you're doing a quick level of implementation, and then you're closing it out. So the size, complexity, and the potential impact of all that stuff will figure out just how many phases you're going to need. Can you do it all in one or not? No matter how many phases you have, all phases have similar characteristics. If they're sequential, then the end of one signals the beginning of the other. There's going to be a handoff. I'll talk about handoffs in the slide for now, but there may be a review or may not be a review, but something has to hand off from one phase to the next. Maybe there's a distinct different focus from one phase to the next, so you need to pay attention to that one phase may be totally different than another phase. And then because of that, the primary deliverable or objective of phase one might be totally different than phase two, and it might require more control, less control, whatever the case may be. And as you repeat through the phases, you're going to run across all of the process groups that the PMI ascribes to. And we'll talk about process groups in a few slides. But those are the collections of things that tend to happen as you're working through a project. You see the phases sort of in the bottom of the slide down here. We're in the left-hand side of the graphic. You have the initiation phase. Just substitute the word phase for process there. You start off with initiating, then you go to planning, then executing, then you go to monitoring and controlling, and closing. And so those are the phases that I'll talk about again in a little while. But you tend to work through all of those, no matter how many times you have to go through them. Sometimes it's once, sometimes it's a bunch. Moving on to the next slide, we'll talk about the bunch ones. The next relationship is called the sequential face-to-face relationships. This comes into play when, as I mentioned, you're moving from one to the next. This graphic here, which is also from the PMBOK, this is figure 2-4 of the PMBOK. So you have three phases here that basically will hand off to each other. So we see this is a hazardous waste site type of cleanup, where first phase is about facility decommissioning, and you're going through a bunch of steps for that. And after you've decommissioned the facility, you're going to move into the waste disposal and the cleanup portion of the project. And then after that, you've torn everything down, and now you're going to landscape over it. And so each one of those things, as you can see, could have a totally different concept aspect for doing it. So they're broken up into various phases. And the step-by-step nature of these things just reduces the uncertainty. That way, if there's something hazardous going on, like in this example, you want to make sure you're not doing landscaping before you've totally gotten rid of all the hazardous stuff in there. And you don't want to start tearing the building down until you've decommissioned everything and all the people are gone, all the processes are done, and things along those lines. All right, so that's the sequential phase relationship. Moving on to the next slide, we have something called an overlapping phase relationship. And this is when you've got one phase that's starting. In this case, the building of a new factory is the graphic we see here. This graphic is figure 2-5 from the PMBOK itself. And we see we're going to design a factory, and perhaps we're in a rush. We want to make things happen quicker. So we start designing, get through the design phase, and at some point in time, we start building before we've totally finished the design. And maybe there's a way to approve the initial stuff. Maybe you started the land prep or something like that because you know you have to clear the forest. Well, it doesn't matter what you're putting in. Maybe if you're going to clear the land off, so you can start that early type of thing. This would be a way to overlap things. Now, for the exam point there, one of the things that you'll learn when we talk about the scheduling knowledge area is a concept called fast-tracking. And the concept called fast-tracking, if you think back one slide where all those phases were sequentially lined up, you didn't start one until you finished the previous one. If you're running out of time and you have to what they call fast-track a project, what you're doing is you're taking those sequential phases and you're overlapping them, just like you see here. where you're starting one phase before you finish another. It reduces the amount of time, theoretically, that it takes to complete a project. It might increase your cost as well, and you've got to balance that, but it will theoretically reduce the time required so you can finish much more quickly. But there are risks involved in doing that, so you have to really pay attention to what's going on if you're going to do overlapping phases and make sure you're not going to do something in a subsequent phase that would be impacted by something you haven't finished in a previous phase. And I'll move on to the next slide and talk about the last relationship, which is the iterative relationship. And this one here, normally it can be done in either sequential or the overlapping, but basically the way it works is you start planning a phase and start working on it, and before you've completed that one, you've started planning the next ones. You're only doing the planning pieces of it. So one phase is planned at any given time, and the planning for the next one is carried out as the work progresses on the current phase. So you get the planning done for phase one, and as soon as you start the work for phase one, you start the planning for phase two. It's sort of like overlapping, but the idea with an overlapping one is you might have had all your planning work done for all the phases, and you're just sort of working through them sequentially. But with the iterative thing, you haven't even completed the earlier phases, and you're already starting subsequent phases. So the scope you have to pay attention to is then managed continuously throughout the process. You're delivering increments. This is sort of what you could say an agile project management framework is all about, because with this type of thing here, you can sort of change things on the fly a bit easier because you're not finished planning things. So if something comes up that you have to change, you get a scope change, you can probably handle it easier with an iterative process, but not necessarily. And it's just one of the aspects that you might be able to do. And maybe some reason for doing that. Maybe if you have to have a certain grouping of team members together in one spot, you only need them for a certain amount of time, you bring those people together for one piece, and you plan a couple of different pieces at the same time, and then you release those folks, and they go off and do other things. And that's all part of iterative face-to-face relationships as well. Moving on to the next slide. Now we're going to get into some of the characteristics a little bit here. And in the beginning of the product life cycle, when things are just starting up, everything is initiated, the costs are very low. Why? Because you haven't spent any money yet. You have no total cost to worry about so much. And you may only have a few team members assigned to your project. But as things move along, you're going to start building costs. You're going to start building staff. And they're going to grow up to a high point, or maybe multiple high points. They can ebb and flow depending upon what's going on with your project. And then eventually, toward the end of the project, they're going to taper off. So we have three exam points to worry about here. The first is that the potential that the project will come to a successful ending is lowest at the beginning of the project. Why? Because it could be canceled before it even starts, or just after it starts, for whatever reason. So the thing to remember is the risk involved. Remember that S-curve risk thing I told you about? Same story here. The potential that the project will actually complete is very low probability that you're actually going to complete the project in the beginning phases, because something could happen and it could be canceled. Second point is the risk is highest at the beginning of the project for the same reason. There could be financial risk, resource risk, whatever. So the risk of losing resources and not being able to do your project is highest at the beginning, because maybe the resources are going to be assigned to a more strategic project than yours is, and you've lost that resource. And then the third point there, stakeholders have the greatest chance of influencing things in the beginning. You're picking between those 10 projects that I talked about earlier. You've got enough funding for two projects, but you've got 10 to consider from. Your stakeholders are going to have a big influence on what goes on, so that they can influence which project gets done. And that's normally done toward the beginning of things. And then with all these things, as time goes on, as you work through your project, if you're 90% of the way through your project, the risk of it being canceled, while non-zero, is certainly small. They're probably going to allow you to complete it. Your stakeholders maybe have moved on to something else. You know, they don't care so much for a project that's 90% done. They know what the end date is. They're fine with it. They want to influence something else. They want the power to influence the next one coming along, so they won't pay attention to you so much. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next slide, talk about handoffs. As we go through all these phase things, there's always a handoff that happens when you end one phase and you start another. So you need to pay attention to the word called handoffs. They call it technical transfers, or process transfers is another thing you could call it as well. The other exam point there is for sequentially phased projects. The end of one phase typically marks approval to move on to the next phase. And for those who don't have the slides in front of them, the word approved is in quotes. you have to make sure that, depending upon your organization, if you need approval to move to the next phase, you secure that approval. You actually achieve that so you can move along. So a lot of times handoffs involve that. I'm going to move to the next slide and talk about some of that. This is called phase completion. And each phase has a specific deliverable, as we've already talked about, or maybe more deliverables, more than one, and that deliverable is going to mark the end of that phase. The design is complete. That's the end of the design phase. Pretty easy to figure out. So the first exam point there, a deliverable is whatever output must be produced by that phase. And once it's produced, you need to review it, make sure that it meets the requirements, and then you might receive approval to move on to the next phase. So what's a deliverable? It's something tangible most of the time. It's something that can be measured, can easily prove, okay, I did this. Here's the design right here. You can see that I've got it. So it's something you can see was actually done. And second exam point there, and a lot of times there'll be a phase end review that allows people to get together in some type of meeting, be it virtual, face-to-face, or whatever. And they have to look over the outputs, make sure you've met all your financial hurdles, things along those lines, all the technology hurdles, all the product hurdles, whatever it is you're doing. And then they will say yes or no to move on to the next phase. They'll determine whether you can go. The third exam point there is that successful conclusion of one phase does not guarantee that you'll be authorized to move to the next phase. You could easily be torpedoed, and there'll be no funding. There'll be a political thing going on where your project is now competing with something else, and your project dies because the other project that needs your resources needs something, or your project deliverable. The deliverable that you see at the top there wasn't up to par. You've done some performance test on something that you've developed, and it's not fast enough, or it's not pretty enough, or it's not whatever enough. And your project won't continue because you have not succeeded. All right? Maybe there's a feasibility study going on for what you have to pay attention to. I've got another slide on feasibility studies a little bit further on. And maybe there's some environmental thing going on, or there's some other type of enormous impact that is going to get in the way. And that might cause you not to successfully go through a phase completion. Whatever. Phase end reviews will give you, the project manager, also your sponsors and your stakeholders, the ability to discover, to address, to take corrective actions against whatever went wrong during the phase as well. You're going to do some lessons learned. You should be doing lessons learned at the end of each phase as well as at the end of the project. And what you can do is take advantage of those things and fix something that's busted or it's not going so well, so that the next time either you or some other project manager comes along, they won't have the same problem. I'm going to move on to the next slide. We've got a couple of graphics here to go through, just describing the impact or the total cost. So this figure we see here on this slide for cost and staffing of projects is actually figure 2-1 from the PMBOK. This exam point you see here will normally be on the test. It has been for the last few months anyway. And the question is, when do the cost and staffing of a project normally peak? And the answer is at roughly the three-quarter mark. And that's what the graphic, that's figure 2-1 from the PMBOK shows you, is that you're going to start off small in the front end. For those who don't have the slides in front of them, there's basically a bell curve, for lack of a better term, and not quite a bell. It's off-centered more to the three-quarter point, as I mentioned, but time is along the x-axis, and cost and staffing levels are the y-axis, and this thing is broken up into phases. So the first quarter or so, roughly the 20% mark, is where the project charter is done. It's in the planning stages. And then up to the next, about a third of the project is maybe when you're working on the project management plan. You still don't have a lot of people, not a lot of costs involved yet, and you're just sort of working out, organizing, and figuring out how you're preparing and planning, how you're going to do things. And then you get into the execution phase, and that's where you're going to bring a lot of people, a lot of resources, a lot of whatever on, and that's when the costs are going to go up. So the curve starts to climb steeper, and it reaches a high point right around that three-quarter mark, and then begins to drop down. And when you get roughly at, about the three-quarter, maybe 80% mark along the time axis, you get into the closing phases of the project, and you're planning closing, and then the costs and staffing begin to drop off. So it's a lot of words to say that one point for the exam question, when do things peak? At the three-quarter point. Moving on to the next slide, we got something slightly similar. This is from another source, from one of the John Wiley books. that shows roughly the same thing, but it gives you the phases. So that's why I tend to use it. It's another graphic with time along the x-axis from day zero to the end of the project. Again, resources along the y-axis, and the phases are broken off slightly differently on the timing between 25 and 30%, those types of things. But in the beginning, you have a conceptual phase, and then you've got initiation phase, and the costs are relatively small. And then you get into planning phases, and the costs go up. And then roughly the three-quarter point, you're in the middle of the executing and the monitoring phase, so your costs are highest, again, at the three-quarter point. And then you start closing things down, or converging, or terminating, whatever term you'd like to use there. You could see all those in the exam. So the costs drop down, and eventually they go away when your project finishes. Moving on to the next slide, we have another graphic as well, talking about project phases again, and some exam points down the bottom. The graphic basically talks about the different outputs that can be achieved in a phase. So you basically have a bunch of deliverables. In this case, in the beginning of a project, you're going to start off with a charter. That's going to be done, maybe even an idea, an input. You have an idea. You could call this a swim lane diagram, where the top swim lane is an input, and then you have phases in the second lane, and then the third lane is project management outputs, and then the fourth lane is the project deliverable. So up in the input side, you've got some deliverables, some ideas to start things off, and then they go into the initial phase. At some point in time, in the outputs of the initial phase, you'll have a charter, you'll have a project management plan, you'll have a scope statement, and then you move into the intermediate phases where you're doing some level of planning. Your plan will come out. You'll snap a baseline or two or three as you're working through your outputs. You'll be doing progress reports, things along those lines. You'll have acceptance of some of the phases that you're going through, and then eventually your project is getting down to the final stages now. You've received approval for the output of your project, and you're into the final closeout stages, and you're going to maybe hand it over to an operational person. Maybe there's not a handover, but there could be a handover. And then the outcome in the lower swim lane there is the product that was the outcome, the final deliverable of your project, whatever it happens to be. And the points you see at the bottom of the slide is there's a lot of different review work and things like that that happen as you work through those phases and producing all those outputs or whatever. And a phase can be closed, as I mentioned before, without taking further action, just going to kill the project. So it's two exam points on this slide. Formal phase completion does not include authorization to begin the next phase. You've heard that already, but we want to cement it in because it will be on the exam. And the other exam point there is if you're going to have a review at the end of a phase, it isn't just called phase end. It could also be called phase exits, phase gates, kill points, murder boards, all kinds of different things. But the idea is you're showing that it's a test to see if something should continue, if your project should maintain life, if you will. All right, I'm going to move on to the next slide. Talk about the feasibility study a little bit more. It's basically something you do in the front end that basically determines whether a project is worth undertaking. Remember all those things, why a project comes about, the market need, the laws changing, things along those lines, customer need. There might be a feasibility study that you would need to do in order to understand, you know, just why should a project occur in the first place. So it's a preliminary assessment of the viability of whatever you want to undertake. And you have to look at things like marketability, if you're developing a product or a service, something along those lines, what the value of that is to your organization. Maybe is it safe? Does it meet industry standards? Can you do something to meet a regulation, to meet a governmental standard, whatever it happens to be? And if you complete your feasibility study and it becomes approved, that doesn't mean that your project is approved. That means it's ready for consideration to start. So just because a feasibility study has a positive outcome doesn't mean your project will be able to get going. It might just be handed off to the design phase if your project is going, but it'll be something in that bucket of stuff that is there for your sponsors and your project management office. If you remember those 10 projects I talked about, a feasibility study might be a requirement for each one of those projects. And they look at that and see what's going on. It's something that you need to pay attention to so that your project could carry on, and pay attention to for the test as well. We're going to move on to the next slide, and we're going to start winding the presentation down here some now because we're getting to the point where we're talking about project management process groups. The PMI, Project Management Institute, put together a framework for you to use in your project. It's not the only framework that exists, but it is the one they have built. and it is the one that is on the exam. So that's the one you have to pay attention to. Whenever you take a certification test, doesn't matter the way you want to do things, be they from a technical point of view, from an ethical point of view, or whatever, you have to answer the question based on what the certifying organization wants you to repeat back to them. So the PMI has said that there are five project management process groups that you pay attention to. And these are things that help you organize the way things are done. And they're roughly subscribed to the phases that we just finished talking about. These can be formed by people, and much like projects, are interrelated, they're dependent. That's the point I wanted to bring out up there. You don't start from the beginning of one process group, finish that one, and then start the next one. They ebb and flow, they interchange. There's pieces that flow all over the place in between the various process groups. And once you get into studying and knowing the innards of the PMBOK, you're going to see all of the flows that happen. An exam point down there is the actual listing of the process groups according to the PMBOK, and they are the initiating group, and then planning, then executing, then monitoring and controlling, and then closing. So these are normally seen as the vertical aspects of a matrix, and we'll get into that in a couple of slides from now. They are the vertical pipes that sort of contain the various processes from the knowledge areas and form the matrix. So let's move to the next slide and begin to talk a little bit more about these, and we'll show you the matrix. Because as I mentioned, the process groups interact a lot. So for process group interactions, these things interact and overlap with each other big time. They are iterative, and they might be revisited over and over again. You may go through the planning stages several times or a piece of the executing process group several times. It depends on what's going on. The PMBOK calls this back and forth, ebbing and flowing, the iterative process, because it's not just done once. It's done over and over and over. And at the conclusion of each process group allows the project manager and the stakeholders to reexamine just what's going on at that phase review. It allows you to decide, well, this project should continue or not. And the graphic that's on here, if you actually go out and buy the Heldman book, it's figure 1-7 in the Heldman book, and it basically shows how things flow, and that you've got a set of boxes that are the five process groups, a box for initiating, for planning, executing, monitoring, and controlling, and closing. And on the left-hand side of the boxes are arrows describing the inputs. On the right-hand side of the boxes are arrows corresponding to the outputs. And when you look at the initiating box, you see not really much anything going into it, but out of the initiating box, it says you're going to the planning box. And then you look at the planning box, and sure enough, the first input arrow you see is initiating. So you know you have things coming from initiating, but you also see monitoring and controlling there as well. So there's aspects for monitoring and controlling that go into planning. And the output of planning, you see it goes to executing. And you look at the inputs for executing, you see planning and monitoring and controlling just like you would expect to see. The outputs of executing are monitoring and controlling because you've got to watch what you're executing. You look down at the monitoring and controlling box, you see executing just like you expected because there's an arrow up above. And you have three outputs coming out of monitoring and controlling. And they go to planning, to executing, and to closing. And then finally, for the closing box, you have just monitoring and controlling as the input there, and you have no outputs because you're done. Right? So, but if you're talking about an iterative phase process, you could theoretically draw another arrow coming from closing and have it going up to the beginning of initiating because you're initiating another phase. But for this example, we didn't do that. But it's theoretically possible to do. But the point of the graphic is just to show that things bounce back and forth to each other, and outputs from one are inputs to the other, as you would expect. There's no real big surprise there. All right, I'm going to move on to the next slide. And we've got a little matrix here for the characteristics of the initiating and the planning process groups. Basically, there's a two-column table. And the left-hand column shows what has low impact or low probability, and those are things like cost, because you haven't spent any money, so there's no impact for cost. Staffing levels, because there's nobody really involved in a project yet, or very few people. And you have low probability of success for project, things that I've already talked about, which is just a more graphic way to show it. And in the right-hand column of the table, you see high impact or high probability. So the first thing to choose there is risk occurrences. So you have a high risk of having things hurt you when you're in these early phases because you don't know what's going to happen yet. And as we've mentioned, stakeholder influence is highest in the initial phases. So that's there as well. Moving on to the next slide. And then we have the characteristics of monitoring, controlling, and closing processes. And again, the same two columns, left-hand column is low impact or probability, right-hand column is high impact or probability, and under the low impact or probability side, now we're toward the back end of the project, the far right-hand end of the project, the closing side, so the stakeholder influence, as we said, is down, is much lower. Staffing levels are starting to go down now because you've got most of the work done. And the risk probability is now low because all that risk planning you've done in your risk planning phases, all those events are probably gone by. You've passed them. They're no longer a risk. You may have one or two closing risks, perhaps, but all the big ones are probably gone. So you don't have so much to worry about from a risk point of view. On the high impact or high probability side, you've got a really high probability that you might actually be able to complete your project. So that's pretty good. But because there are still some risks, if you're toward the end, the risk impact can still be kind of high. So you got to pay attention to your risks and make sure that you're not overlooking something, thinking, well, all risks are gone. Well, no, our risks aren't gone. They certainly have a lower probability of occurring. But if they do occur, they probably have a much higher impact, better way to say it. So a low probability of occurring, but a high impact if they do occur. And moving on to the next slide, we have something called the plan, do, check, act cycle, or the cycle. This is something that you'll see a lot in the test, a lot in a lot of the study materials. It was initially put out by a guy named Walter Short and revised by a guy named Bill Deming. And then basically he says there is an iterative process here as well, that first you're going to plan, then you're going to do, then you're going to check, then you're going to act, and you're going to keep on doing that. So the plan, do, check, act cycle is an underlying concept within the PMI and the PMBOK. Remember those phase things that we showed? You saw the cycle in there. That's a lot of the plan, do, check, act thing going on in there. That's what this is here as well. It's iterative, and that the output of one cycle becomes the input of another. We've already talked about that as well. So I'm going to move on to the next slide, and we have a slightly different sense of the same thing, where we're now showing vertically a bunch of boxes where at the top of the box we have the initiating phase, and we're just showing that from a point of view as you get into a project. In this case, we're talking about the feasibility study of the planning phase of a project. You can do plan, do, check, act inside that phase, and inside a plan, do, check, act, you're cycling around between the process groups. So everything sort of mixes and matches, and it's all convoluted inside because it's all iterative. It all happens more than once, and you get your progressive elaboration. Remember one of the first slides we talked about is progressive elaboration, and it all just sort of flows together, and you can do the same interaction in this bigger box that you see here in the rest of the circles that are in here from initiating to closing, and then you're back into initiating of something else. So it just sort of all goes together. And you can go through all the phases a lot. And as I get down to almost the final slide, we start talking about the project management knowledge areas. So I'm going to move to the next slide and talk about the project management knowledge areas. There are nine of them that you see here. I'll read them for those who don't have the slides in front of them. They are integration, scope, time, cost, quality, human resources, communications, risk, and procurement. These are the horizontal pieces of the project management process matrix. The process groups with the vertical slices, if you will, slicing down through various aspects of the knowledge areas. Then the integration knowledge area is everything to do with integrating a project, all the various pieces of a project. And scope is all the scope and planning pieces of project plan development pieces of a project. Time is obviously scheduling and time management. Cost is obviously cost. Then you have quality management, human resource, the communications plan, how you're going to communicate, how you're going to do your risk planning, and if you're doing procurement, how are you doing procurement. So those things go horizontally, and the process groups go vertically. So let's move to the next slide and actually show you that. This is the last slide we'll talk about tonight, and it basically is Table 3-1 in the PMBOK. So if you go to the PMBOK, you'll see this. It's meant to be an eye chart here because I wanted to put it all on one slide and just show you that across the column headers on this chart are the process groups. So you see initiating process, planning process, executing process, monitoring, controlling process, and closing process groups. You see the knowledge areas going down horizontally. So you see in project integration management knowledge area, you've got six different processes that you're dealing with. You look at the intersection of the cells. You see one process in the intersection between initiation process group and the project integration management knowledge area. where some of the process groups look down at the intersection of time management and planning. There are five processes just in that one thing alone. So what this chart does is it tells you that in the beginning, if you read the process groups vertically left to right, when you're in the beginning phases of a project or of a phase, there's only a couple of things you're going to do. And one of them is in the project integration management area that is working on the charter. And the other is in the communications area where you're going to identify your stakeholders. Where when you move to the next phase, the next group, that's the planning group. There's a whole lot of work that's done in the planning group. As you can see, the bulk of the processes are there. There are 42 processes as you work through all of these cells in the matrix. And the bulk of them, the biggest percentage of them, are in this vertical planning group. They stretch across all the knowledge areas, but the planning process group has the most processes in it. And that might be a test question as well. You never know. They could be silly enough to put that in there. And then when you get into the executing process group, you see a few processes smothered here or there. There isn't an entry in each cell of the matrix, where in the planning process group, there was an entry in every single cell. And then moving further on to the right-hand side in the monitoring and controlling, you've got entries in most of the cells. There's one that doesn't have anything in it, but you see that there is some work that goes down there. And then finally, with the closing, there's only two processes again, and that belongs to the integration management and the procurement piece when you're closing things out. So that's how this is organized, and this chart will hopefully be on your brain dump if you're doing a brain dump when you're getting ready to take the test. If you don't know what a brain dump is, basically when you go to take the test, you sit down, and once you say, yes, I am Dana Safford, and I'm here to take the PMP exam, you have 20 minutes to take the tutorial that shows you how to take the test. Well, hopefully you've done enough practice tests online that you're going to know what the test process is on the screen. You know where the calculator is. You know where the timer is, things along those lines. So instead of just blowing through and not paying attention to the tutorial and starting the test, take that 15, 20 minutes and take a blank piece of paper that they'll give you going into the test and write some of this stuff down. That's what the brain dump does. You could build this matrix and a bunch of other stuff, all the formulas for earned value management and such, inside of 15 minutes if you practice your brain dump religiously, if you will, so that you can reproduce it on a blank piece of paper inside of 15 minutes while the tutorial is going down, and make sure you watch the timer so the timer doesn't expire, because you don't want the timer to expire. And then for as much as your brain dump you get done, fantastic, because then in the middle of the test you don't have to remember what was that process in the project time group that I had to pay attention to in monitoring and controlling. It might be on your brain dump. Or if you were trying to remember what a formula was for earned value management from the cost knowledge area, that'll be on your brain dump as well. You don't have to try to remember while the test timer is running. So a brain dump does that for you. There's a brain dump in the file area. There's also one in the lobby of Free C. If you happen to be in the Free C area right now, part of the bunch of folks who are sitting in the live conference call, download the brain dump. I just updated it the other day, put a couple extra things in there. So go grab the brain dump, and this is what you'll do as you are getting ready to take the test. So I think I'm done, because my next slide says questions. So I'm going to unmute everybody's phone, and let's see if there are any questions out there. Your phones are now unmuted, and are there any questions out there from anybody?
Yes, one.
Hey, Dana, this is Judy. How are you?
Hey, Judy. How are we doing? All right. What's up?
I really like slide 39 about the interactions.
Okay.
Of the five process groups. I think one of the outputs that's worthy of note would be lessons learned after each of the process groups.
Right, right, absolutely. Remember, this slide is saying where do the outputs from this process go? So the outputs from initiating tend to go to planning, and the outputs from executing tend to go to monitoring and controlling. We're not talking about the outputs as in the each of the processes. That's an unfortunate set of words that they chose in the book for this graphic. So anyone who studied for the test knows that each of those individual 42 processes that are on that last slide in the matrix has their own set of inputs, tools and techniques, and outputs. The inputs and outputs on slide 39, which is the process group interaction slide, are not those same inputs and outputs.
Yep.
But your point is still very valid. You always want to make sure that anytime you can capture a lesson learned as an output, you definitely want to do that.
And don't wait till closing.
Don't wait till the end. If you can do it in the middle of things, fantastic. Throw it in there. Just keep a little running log somewhere, a Word document, a OneNote file, or whatever you happen to have, a spreadsheet. keep it and keep track of them and use them and allow people to go behind you to use them. That's why you're taking lessons learned in the first place.
Yep.
I have one question. This is Charles, Dan.
Go ahead, Charles.
When talking about project phases, there's no longer any mention about milestones when you transition from one phase to the other in Tembok 4, because that's the terminology that was previously used.
But you'll still see milestones in any of the software that's around. So, yeah, a milestone is certainly going to be there. A milestone in the PMBOK vernacular is just an activity with no duration. Oh. I was going to say duration with no activity. It's the other way around. It's an activity with 0 days duration. You say, hey, I'm done with this thing. You can still do milestones. Absolutely can do them. You can choose to say you have a milestone at the end of this phase that you're done with that phase. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't think that's going to be on the test, should you have a milestone at the end of there. So while the PMBOK may not include the use of milestones directly, it certainly does not say don't use them either.
Of course. One other thing, when we talked about the tools, I understand, you know, out there in the real world, different tools, different software is used from one vertical industry to the other. And I understand that there's a reason for that because there's specialized areas. But I don't see anyone specifically, and I know the reason why, they don't recommend any particular tool for any particular industry. Is there anybody doing that, saying, well, you know, I'd rather use Microsoft Project for this type of industry, and this is the tool of
sure, yeah. You go on the Internet to some of the consulting groups. They'll certainly tell you which tool they'd like you to use. Just go search for project management tools, Google it or whatever search engine you want to use, Bing it, Google it, whatever the case may be, and you'll find lots of recommendations for various things to use. Now, most of the time when there's a recommendation, someone's probably getting a piece of the action when that's happening. But there are certainly some tools that are more suited for doing a particular activity or a particular phase than something else. And I think you'll find that if you look at some of the websites for industry groups, you'll see a lot more maybe non-paid announcements for certain tools because they have better interaction with an aspect of something than others. But certainly the PMI tries not to get involved in that. They want to try to remain somewhat aloof to all that, and they prescribe use a tool. You'll see a lot of different tools and techniques in the executing phases and monitoring and controlling. It'll be project management software is the tool. You know, you go pick the one you want. You know, I've mentioned a few: Microsoft Project, TeamPlay, Primavera, Open Workbench. It depends on how deep your pockets are, because some of those are real expensive.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
But if you're doing something for a volunteer project for a civic organization or a religious organization that don't have deep pockets at all, then you might want to use Open Workbench because it's free. It has its limitations because it's free, but it might get you what you need. You never know. Any other questions out there from anybody? No? Okay. Well, that was an easy one for questions here. All right. So now let me get into my outro here, and then what I'll do is pause again once the nice lady says the conference is no longer being recorded, and then I'll answer any other questions anybody has as well. So as a reminder, PM Lessons Learned conducts 3 conference calls each month. This is the monthly PMP study group conference call. We're in Elm because it is the first Thursday of the month. On the second Thursday of each month, we have the PM Lessons Learned Job Shop call where folks in transition or with a need to identify potential career paths can go to help each other. And finally, on the third Thursday of each month, we have the PM Lessons Learned Best Practice call. This is where we provide presentations on a wide variety of project management and soft skill topics. So pay attention to those as you need to. Okay, so that's it for this session of the monthly PMP exam study group conference call and podcast. I'll again thank the live participants on this call and everyone that downloads the podcast. And speaking of the podcast, in the last 2 years that I've been hosting these conference calls, you folks have downloaded over 15,000 copies of this PM Lessons Learned PMP monthly exam study group. I thank you, and all of us at PMLessonsLearned.com thank you as well, and hope that you will continue to do that. Thank you so much. So I'll remind you that we are PMLessonsLearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. My name is Dana Safford. So long, and keep on learning.
This has been a PM Lessons Learned podcast. Project managers helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Come join our group. Visit our website at PMLessonsLearned.com. Till next time, keep on learning.